This is Focus 580, our morning talk program, the second hour of the show. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Henry Freinas at the controls this morning. In this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking with historian Lawrence Goldstone about a book that he's authored that's entitled Dark Bargain, that takes a look at the history of the Constitution of the United States. The Constitutional Convention took place in Philadelphia between May and September of 1787. And the men that got together there to put together the Constitution, says our guest, disagreed on almost everything. But there was no issue that was more contentious, that was of greater concern than the issue of slavery. In fact, says our guest, to a significant degree, America's most sacred document was shaped by the most notorious institution in its history. The subtitle of his book is Slavery, Profits, and the Struggle for the Constitution. The book Dark Bargain is published by Walker & Company. If you'd like to read it, it's out in the bookstores now. Questions are also welcome here on this program after we talk. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So at any point, questions are certainly welcome. All you need to do is call in. We just ask people, however, to be brief, and that will help us get in as many callers as possible and keep the program moving. But again, questions welcome. 333-9455. And toll-free, 800-222-9455. Mr. Goldstone, hello.
Hello there.
Thanks. Thank you, David. Well, thanks for talking with us. We appreciate it. Several things strike me as being major points that we just might hit a little bit at the beginning and before we get into the subject in greater detail. And I guess one of them, one that comes to mind first, is that the sectional divisions that we particularly associate with the Civil War, particularly the fears, concerns of people in the South that they would be dominated by the North, these kinds of sectional concerns, they were there from the very start.
Yes. The southern states were outnumbered both in terms of population and in terms of number. About 65% of the free population lived in the north. And, of course, there were eight free states and five slave states. Delaware was considered a free state. There were about 15% of the population were slaves, and some, they were a little bit of a slave state, but mostly identified with the north. When walking in the door in 1787, the five slave states were enormously afraid. In fact, Pierce Butler, a delegate from South Carolina, said that freeing the Negroes was something that people both within and without doors were trying to do. So these five states came to Philadelphia with the understanding that they had to protect a position as a minority member of the United States. Mm.
It's something else that again, I think maybe people don't fully appreciate, maybe I didn't, is that to the extent to which that these people who crafted this Constitution, and then after that, all those who signed on to it, didn't know how long this government would last. And in fact, you use in the text, and maybe people, I don't know if people did then, but you used the word experiment, that people saw this as an experiment, and they really had no idea how long it would last, and they might indeed be a little surprised that it lasted as long as it has.
Well, what was interesting was that the 13, well, there were only 12, of the 13 states, the 12 that were represented, Rhode Island didn't send any delegates. They walked in the door of the statehouse feeling much more a citizen of the state which they represented than of the United States in general. John Rutledge, who is in my view, one of the most important delegates from South Carolina, had been educated in England. After he returned, he was sent to the Stamp Act Congress in 1765, and he wrote to his mother that his trip to New York was his first trip to a foreign country. This was a man who had spent 4 years in England. So one of the major problem the delegates had was getting each other to identify with this larger country. The Articles of Confederation, which ruled the country at the time, was specified as an agreement of friendship. So it was very experimental, not simply in terms of how they created the government and the various entities that they created legislatively or in the executive or in the judiciary, but simply the idea that they were now going to form one country.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess the thing that we always think about is the struggle between, or those people who felt that there should be some kind of a strong central government, and those people who felt that the state government, the states, should be stronger. I'm not sure if that was more important than this concern about the states among themselves, who either blocks of states or individual states, which ones were going to emerge to be more ultimately more important.
What was interesting was a number of state delegations arrived, Delaware in particular, arrived with specific instructions from its state legislature that it was not to agree to any new system, but simply a reform of the old system, which, of course, the states were very powerful under the Articles. In fact, the national government's weakness was the reason that the convention was called in the first place. So, the fact that many of these delegates who arrived at Philadelphia with specific instructions or a particular belief that a central government should not be empowered to do too much, changed their minds and actually signed the document, which was obviously a much stronger central government than any of them had anticipated going in, is an indication that those feelings were, if not ephemeral, at least subject to persuasion. I think the sectional issue that you referred to earlier was much stronger, and those opinions didn't change, and most of the delegates who arrived, almost all, in fact, who arrived with the idea of protecting a sectional interest, left with the idea that they either had protected that interest and signed the Constitution, or that the new government did not protect their interest. George Mason of Virginia is the delegate I focus on, and refused to sign the Constitution.
Hmm. It seems to me that you're making here an essential argument, and again, I think it will be something, a new way, perhaps, of people thinking about early America and about the Constitution. And I think that we're used to this idea, sort of the received wisdom, that slavery was preserved in order to persuade the southern states to sign on, and that it was something that perhaps some people in the North didn't like. They didn't like the idea, but they felt that it was something that they simply had to do to get the southern states to cooperate. And you and people, I think, certainly understand just how important slaves and slavery were to the economy of the South. Here, now, you're making an argument that says, well, let's not forget the role of slavery in the economy of the North, and
Absolutely.
That you're arguing that there were people in the North who also wanted to see slavery continue because they may not have owned slaves, but they were part of an economy that depended on slavery.
Well, depended on it might be strong, but they certainly profited from it. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think one thing, we have to take a step back, because the sectional division at the Civil War, which was North and South, was not the same as the sectional division in 1787. There were three slave economies, in effect, in 1787. The lower South, South Carolina and Georgia, grew rice. Rice was grown in horrible conditions in swamps. Slave mortality was extremely high. Rice was very, very profitable. But the lower South, South Carolina and Georgia, because of the conditions and because of slave mortality, needed a constant influx of male slaves. And the cheapest place to get those slaves was Africa. So the South Carolinians and the Georgians came to Philadelphia wanting to protect both slavery and the slave trade. In Virginia, Maryland, North Carolina, where they grew tobacco, the situation was far different. Tobacco was grown under what, by comparison, were bucolic conditions, rolling hills, a favorable climate. Slaves bred rather than died. And by 1787, the most reliable population estimate has the number of slaves in Virginia outnumbering the number of whites. The Virginians were going into debt. Slavery was a horrifically uneconomic system. You had to support a slave from birth until death. If the slave lived to 70 years old and had a productive life of 25 years, you spent 45 years supporting them. Now, the support was meager, but it did cost money. The Virginians found themselves in debt. They found themselves overwhelmed by the slave population and were desperate to to sell their excess, to get rid of the excess, and the obvious place to sell them was to the South Carolinians. But the price was too high. The slave trade across the Atlantic was undercutting the price. So the Virginians particularly came to Philadelphia wanting to protect slavery as an institution, but wanting to end the slave trade. The Northerners, of course, were the shippers. They not only shipped the rice and the tobacco to Europe, but they also brought back all the fineries that the Southern planters needed to support the lifestyle that they had come to expect. So you had these three, it was a constant game of rock, paper, scissors. So there were shifting alliances all through the 4 months between the Upper South, the Lower South, and the North. And ultimately, the North made a bargain with the Lower South to extend the slave trade in return for favorable commerce treatment in the Constitution, which to me was the dark bargain. Mm-hmm. And another irony, and maybe something we can talk about later, is that is precisely the situation currently in Iraq, with the North and the South squeezing the center. They also have three political, socio-political systems fighting it out for power. So it was not as simple as a North-South division. And if you look at it that way, a lot of things will jump off the paper at you. Mm.
Our guest, Lawrence Goldstone, hosts PhD in American Constitutional Studies. He is the author of the book Dark Bargain: Slavery, Profits, and the Struggle for the Constitution, published by Walker and Company. Questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Did anyone come into the Constitutional Convention with the intention of or the desire of getting rid of slavery then and there?
I don't believe you can go that far. There were one or two delegates, one delegate in particular who was a genuinely abolitionist delegate, and his name was Luther Martin, and he was the Attorney General of Maryland for 30 years. In fact, in the landmark case of McCulloch versus Maryland, he represented Maryland and lost. Martin was one of the great characters at the convention. He was a notorious drunk. He was amazingly voluble. He would get up and speak for hours and hours at a time. But he also had a razor-sharp intellect and was probably the only man there who would refuse to back a constitution that was pro-slavery on moral grounds. But there were nobody walked into the idea that this was going to be a time that we would end slavery.
One of the things that I thought was interesting was the fact that the debates that took place within the Constitutional Convention were secret. It was all behind closed doors. Why was that? And why were the delegates? Why did they want to make sure that no one would really know what sort of debates and discussions were going on?
Well, there were two reasons. First of all, they didn't want a constant input from the public complaining about one particular debate or another. But more importantly, they understood that many of the things that would be said were not things they would want to be quoted on. There were two ironies, one of which was when the delegates went home to talk about ratification, many of the pro-ratification delegates completely misrepresented the debates, knowing that no one could object because the records had been secret. What is more important than the records being secret during the course of the convention is that the delegates wanted the records to remain secret in perpetuity. The cursory record of the debates, which was the official journal, which was little more than just a record of the votes, was not published until 1820. And it was not until 1840, 3 years after James Madison died, and his papers were published, that a detailed record of the convention was available to the American public. And it resulted in William Lloyd Garrison reading Madison's notes and saying that this is a covenant with hell and demanding that the North secede from the Union, because he read the records and saw just how pro-slavery not only the document was, but the debates that resulted in the documents were.
Hmm. You, I think, write in the book that a major point that you're making is that the Constitution was indeed shaped by slavery, and yet it was the kind of thing that for a long time historians didn't acknowledge, and I think that probably within the popular imagination, to the extent that people know much about the Constitution at all, they might indeed be surprised by such a statement. Yeah. Why is it that it seems that it wasn't something that was not acknowledged by historians for a long time, and now today this seems to be a radical kind of, or at least where some people would find it to be a shocking kind of thing to say.
It is definitely considered a shocking thing today. I think there are two reasons. First of all, the first reason is obvious. The Constitution is our most sacred document. It is unpleasant to think that something as ghastly as slavery and the economics of slavery would have a large impact on the way that document was shaped. I think another reason, though, one which has an irony to it, is that most constitutional scholars look at the finished document as if it had sprung fully formed from James Madison's forehead. They don't look at the debates particularly, but simply analyze the clauses of the Constitution. If you do that, it appears that the debates were an intellectual exercise, that the compromises were the product of people deciding issues of checks and balances, say, or where power should reside, or deciding whether Montesquieu or John Locke or Blackstone should have the most influence on the way the Constitution was wrought. And if you look at it that way, and if you look at the Constitution as a finished document, there are certain clauses, such as the Three-Fifths Clause, which are obviously slave-related, but the underlying influence of slavery is lost. If, however, you look at the debates as a political meeting, just the same as every other political meeting in the history of human interaction, with people coming in with ideas of protecting self-interest, their region, their states, that their interest might be parochial and not simply intellectual, and you read the debates in that manner, the influence of slavery is simply unmistakable.
Well, it seems that there was in their thinking about what the government was going to look like, particularly what the legislative branch was going to look like, there was indeed going back to this concern about the which states would have the influence and
right.
which states would have the power. There was this big concern about how it is that the thing was going to be structured, and how would the interests and the powers of the various states be sorted out and balanced, and that's how it is we eventually came to this idea where you have the legislature, one body of which has the same representation from every state, and the other body, the representation is based on population. And then the further step, no doubt in the interest of the people in the South, was to decide that you're going to count the slaves. Not one for one, but that as you were going to count three-fifths of them, so a slave was counted as three-fifths of a person.
Right.
That definitely was something that was shaped by concerns about slavery and also about the South trying to bump up their representation and their power by counting the slaves, or at least by counting some part of the slaves.
Yeah. Well, there are a couple of things to be looked at here. Which first of all, one of the effects of the Three-Fifths Clause, once the states had secured three-fifths of their slaves in apportionment for the lower house, for the population-based house, they could no longer allow a popular vote for the president because that three-fifths bump was going to be lost. Clearly, each slave owner wasn't going to be allowed 1.6 votes for president, nor were 60% of the slaves going to be allowed to line up at the ballot box. So once the three-fifths clause was agreed to, the Electoral College became inevitable. And therefore, to some small degree or some larger degree, every minority president, every president, including the current one, who was elected with a less popular votes than his opponent, but won because of the Electoral College, owes his election to some degree to slavery.
Huh.
Also, now, while most historians, it's very hard to look at the Three-Fifths Clause with relation to the lower house and say this had nothing to do with slavery, the upper house, the Senate, was also very much in play with the slaveholders in the free states. The situation at the time was 8 free states, 5 slave states. But the country was exploding westward. There were going to be an enormous number of new states in the union within 20 or 25 years, and everyone knew it. So the southern states had to find some way also to protect their interests there. And what happened was, at the same time that the Three-Fifths Clause was being agreed to in Philadelphia, 90 miles away in New York City in Congress, the Congress voted with one dissenting vote, that by a New Yorker, to approve the Northwest Ordinance. Now, the Northwest Ordinance banned slavery north of the Ohio River in all the territories. And many of the delegates were the same as the congressional delegates. They were ferrying back and forth. So you ask, why would the Southern delegates, who were ferociously protecting slavery in Philadelphia, agree to ban it north of the Ohio in New York? And the reason was this huge Northwest Territory was limited to a maximum of five new states, where below the Ohio, from the Ohio River to the Mississippi to the Gulf of Mexico, that was expected to yield as many as 10 new states. So the Southerners because the population was expected to trend southwest. So if the Southerners could hold on, they would have 5 plus 10, which is 15, and the North would have their 8 plus 5 maximum in the Northwest, which was 13. So the way the Senate debates went on also were directly related to the slave issue.
Yeah, that's interesting. That indeed this whole business was influenced by what would at the time would have been talked about in terms of as westward expansion, although at that point it was everything between the Mississippi and the Appalachians. That was the West.
Right.
Then.
That was the West.
Yeah.
Beyond the Mississippi was unthought of at the time, but the Mississippi, navigation of the Mississippi was also a major sectional issue.
Let's take a caller here. We have someone listening in Danville. I'd like to jump in on our line number 4 right here. Hello.
Good morning. This is a most interesting topic this morning. I have 3 questions, and I'll ask the more important one first, and then if you have time, the other two. I've been reading Peter Iron's History of the Supreme Court, and he delves into this early constitutional convention. And he mentions this, too. Why did not Rhode Island send a delegate, and why were they so reluctant to ratify the Constitution?
Rhode Island at the time was run by what was considered by the other states a radical agrarian government. Rogue's Island, they called it. There was a lot of illicit shipping. I said earlier that each of the members of the states considered themselves more identified more with their home state. Rhode Island did not want to allow itself to become under the rule of any centralized government. They were shipping to Connecticut, they were shipping to New York, and they were just, it was a very radical government that did not want in any way to cede authority to centralized power, and they simply refused to send delegates. They were the last of the 13 states to ratify also.
Yes. Then of the 3 delegates that did not sign, 2 of whom were from Virginia, they gave as their reason that they felt that the Constitution, as written, gave Congress too much power and individual rights were not addressed. Why in the world didn't they take this up while the convention was assembled?
Well, the reason they didn't take it up was that they weren't really telling the truth. George Mason, who of the 3 who didn't sign, no, Elbridge Gerry from Massachusetts,
right.
he was quixotic at best. But of the 2 Virginia delegates, Edmund Randolph and George Mason, George Mason was by far the most influential. He had arrived, he was George Washington's mentor, he had arrived at Philadelphia as a strong force for a central government, for a more powerful central government. In fact, Washington and Mason were friends for 30 years, and that friendship ended after the convention because Mason refused to sign. If you look at the letters, it is clear that Mason did not refuse to sign because of the lack of a Bill of Rights.
Oh.
He refused to sign in the wake of the debate that extended the slave trade for 20 years. And it's right in the record. He says it then, and Madison later wrote to Washington that Mason was being somewhat disingenuous in his public pronouncements as to why he refused to sign the Constitution, that it had nothing to do with individual liberties, but had much more to do with economic issues. Mason understood that slavery was strangling Virginia. He understood that a 20-year continuation of the slave trade was going to put Virginia on such a terrible footing economically and cause already debt-ridden planters to be that much more debt-ridden. And then with the idea that the northern commercial interests, there would be no control on their shipping rates, that they would be able to exclude foreign shipping, exclude competition, Mason refused to sign the Constitution, in my opinion, based on that compromise, which was concluded in the last week in August.
I see. Well, my last one is, did the impetus or the precursor of this convention result from the attempt to adjudicate the Oyster Wars, the four states along the Chesapeake Bay?
There were people who wanted a stronger central government, Madison in particular, John Dickinson, Hamilton, and as rivalries between states boiled up, they tried to call conventions. In fact, the Annapolis Convention, which was the precursor to the Constitutional Convention, which dealt with the Maryland, Virginia, the dispute over use of the Chesapeake. That was a result of two previous meetings, one of which was at Mount Vernon. But Madison was going to use this to try to expand it and deal with commerce. The Annapolis Convention was called to deal with commerce and was supposed to include all 13 states, but only five states sent representatives. So in a way, it wasn't really as a result of these issues. It was as a result of people understanding that they could use these issues to bring up broader questions.
I see. Just another step along the way.
Yes.
Well, thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
All right. Well, thanks for the call. We are a little bit past the midpoint of this second hour of Focus 580. Our guest is Lawrence Goldstone. We are talking about his book, Dark Bargains, Slavery, Profits, and the Struggle for the Constitution. It is published by Walker and Company. Questions are welcome here on the program. If you're here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, the local number, 333-9455. Also, we have a toll-free line, so that means if it would be a long-distance call for you, we'll pay for the call. That's 800-222-9455. The next is someone listening in Bloomington, and it's line one. Hello.
Hi, is it me?
Yes.
Okay, you mentioned that the delegates to the Constitutional Convention were virtually the same men who passed the Northwest Ordinance. And I think the contents of that Northwest Ordinance demonstrate very clearly that our Constitution did not intend to separate church and state. Let me read you Article 3 of the Northwest Ordinance. By the way, it's interesting to note that both Illinois and Indiana entered the Union under the Northwest Ordinance. The Northwest Ordinance was an ordinance determining or prescribing how new states could enter the Union. And the state of Illinois entered the Union under the Northwest Ordinance. And Article 3 of the Northwest Ordinance says this. It says, religion, morality, and knowledge being necessary to good government and the happiness of mankind, schools and the means of education shall forever be encouraged. In other words, our founding fathers, the men who wrote our Constitution, wanted religion taught in our schools.
Well, I think that that's a bit of a stretch. Now, what I said was that there were many delegates to the Constitutional Convention who also held congressional credentials, and many of them went back and forth. The men who passed the 18 votes Northwest Ordinance were, I think a couple of them were delegates, but very few. Also, there were any number of provisions ordinance that had yet to be introduced to the country at large, right of contract. Certainly, you cannot say slavery was prohibited in the Northwest Ordinance, and you certainly couldn't say that the Founding Fathers were trying to abolish slavery. I think that also religion then had a different meaning than religion now. But what you say in terms of the separation of church and state not being at the Constitutional Convention is completely true. In fact, one of the John Jay, who was not a delegate, was he was a Huguenot descendant, and he wanted to have laws passed prohibiting Catholics from holding office, and he was talked out of it by Alexander Hamilton. So there were a lot of religious questions, and the men in Philadelphia were certainly religious in a vague kind of way, but many of them were kind of proto-Unitarians also. So while they understood that religion was important in American life, I don't think you can come out of the debates and say that there was any specific desire by the delegates that religion should either be included in schools or included in governmental functions or be excluded. It was not something that was dealt with until the first Congress when James Madison introduced the 14 amendments that later were reduced to 12 and then 10 were passed, which became the Bill of Rights.
All right. Well, let's go on to another caller here. This is Chicago in line 4. Hello.
Good morning. This discussion is absolutely fascinating, and I have 1,000 questions, but the two I think I'm going to ask are more about constitution making than your specific topic. The first one is that Venezuela has now produced a pocket-sized constitution so all the citizens can read and actually get to know their constitution. Is the language of our constitution too archaic that we would not be able to do that? Because that just seemed to me such a terrific idea. That's the first question. The second question is, as you watch the constitution-making process in Iraq, what do you see after someone who studied constitution-making and the ins and outs of it?
So thank you for asking me that. Let me answer the second question first.
Okay.
The Iraqi process is fascinating to me, particularly in our government's efforts to influence it. Two things to remember. First of all, our Constitution did not prevent our Civil War. It is very important to remember that although it took 85 years, the issues that were left vague in the Constitution that were not dealt with, slavery in particular, just boiled up over those 85 years until they resulted in a Civil War. So the notion that the creation of a Constitution in and of itself is going to prevent a Civil War in Iraq, I think, is foolish. Secondly, a constitution is a wonderful document for people who have a desire to live under the rule of law, who have agreed to give up certain individual rights, certain regional rights, certain secular rights, in order to make a better whole. Constitutions don't work for people who do not have that belief. The most democratic constitution probably in the history of humanity was the Bolshevik constitution, and obviously that didn't do them a whole lot of good. So this idea that imposing a constitution in and of itself is going to create democracy or even further democracy in Iraq, I think is foolish. And I think it is even more foolish to say that by imposing rights for women, minority rights, in their constitution, that it's actually going to make a difference in the way people function. Whether or not Iraq succeeds in becoming a democracy, as we see a democracy, will be as a result of whether the people there want it enough to do what is necessary to give up certain power, to compromise, to accept the rights of people that they don't necessarily get along with or even like, in order to have a stronger and more vibrant nation. If they don't have that belief, they're not going to have a nation regardless of what the paper is. What is also interesting to me is something I alluded to earlier, is that the Iraqi constitutional process, in terms of the division of the country into north, center, and south, is exactly what the process was in our convention in Philadelphia, and it resulted in Virginia being a very strong anti-federalist state, although they ultimately did ratify the Constitution. And it was part of that issue that was never resolved and festered for 85 years. To go back to your first question, I think it would be great. Our constitutional language is a little challenging. It was given after everything was agreed to. The document was given to a committee of style. And one of the men on it was Gouverneur Morris, who was a New Yorker, but he was a Pennsylvania delegate. And he was the most elegant writer of the 55 men who had come and passed through. And he was given the job of writing a stylistic constitution. And he did a wonderful job. It's a beautifully written document. It's a little confusing in spots. And there are also a number of provisions that have just passed with time. But I think that Americans, being more acquainted with their Constitution, reading their Constitution, talking about the provisions in the Constitution, much as the citizenry of the United States did before ratification, would only help us. Knowledge, awareness, not taking a third party's word for it, but reading through it oneself, there is no substitute for that. And I think whatever vehicle was introduced to make Americans more aware of what their constitutional process really was, the better, the stronger country we will have.
May I ask one more question?
Sure.
I get the impression from what you just said about the Iraqi constitution is that you sort of feel it's going to fall apart probably a moment after it's passed, because the impression that I have is that there are actually people more willing in creating their own, at least among the politicians, of protecting their own rights, and there really isn't any desire for this unified country except among some Sunnis and most Americans. So my impression is that you don't feel this constitution can hold.
No, the answer, I don't know. I'm not an Iraqi expert. I don't think the constitution will hold unless there is a commitment by the people of the country to live by it. I don't think the presence of the constitution will create democracy. Whether or not there is enough momentum in that country to give up certain rights. You know, our constitutional process, which I tried to detail in the book, was one of horse trading. It was a lot of people. The reason our constitution worked was that people went and hashed out a bunch of issues. See, if you look at our constitutional process as a political meeting, as a meeting of people with vested self-interests, compromising, negotiating, making deals, to try to achieve as much protection for those interests as possible, then you see our Constitution and the fact that it did work in an entirely different light. I don't have a problem that the Iraqi factions are trying to fight it out, get as much power. The Kurds are trying to get as much power for themselves, the Shia, the Sunnis, various subgroups within that. I think that's very healthy. In the end, however, each group has to walk away and say, I got enough that I'm willing to give up that which I did not get in order to have this country function. If people walk away thinking, my group was completely disenfranchised, we have nothing to gain by living under this constitutional process, or not enough to gain, then the Constitution will fall apart. How it will play out ultimately, I don't know. But what I do know is that the propagandizing that the existence of the Constitution is going to somehow create a better country over there, that I don't think is true.
Okay, thank you.
All right,
thanks. You're
welcome. We have about 15 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Our guest is Lawrence Goldstone. He's the author of the book Dark Bargains, Slavery, Profits, and the Struggle for the Constitution. It's published by Walker & Company, and it does look closely at the role that slavery played in the crafting of the Constitution. Books out there in the bookstore if you want to take a look at it. We have some other callers here we'll bring into the conversation. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana is the number to call. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Next to someone here in Champaign-Urbana where we are, line number two. Hello.
Hi, any details on the debt for the planters that you mentioned? For example, it said the cotton gin helped revive bondage by making it more productive. And in the North, a construction gang got $20 a month and did the job and then had to look for something else. But it said under bondage, the persons in bondage had to be provided for, in a manner of speaking, year-round, and so had to be producing something like cotton.
Well, cotton, as I'm sure you know, was not a major crop during the 1780s. The cotton gin allowed them to separate the seeds and therefore made it economic. But the principle is correct. The idea that slavery was a free system, you know, one has to ask oneself, why would planters, seeing how crippling this system was, a slave is born, obviously nothing can be done, the slave is property, you protect your property, you're not going to put an infant to work, you're not going to put a five-year-old to work, there are little chores perhaps, but you are supporting that boy or girl for 10 years, 12 years, however long it takes, food, clothing, housing, medicine, as rudimentary as it might have been, and getting no return. The comparison with the construction gang is excellent. Construction gang leaves, you no longer have to pay them a salary. If you look at that and you ask yourself why the planters would allow themselves to perpetuate such a ridiculously uneconomic system, you can only come to the conclusion that it had something to do with a way of life, that it had something to do with the way they looked at themselves, with the way they thought, how they thought of themselves, how they were thought of in the larger community, that it becomes a much more sociological issue than an economic issue. So slavery, yeah, I mean, Cotton definitely saved the slave system by introducing another high-profit commodity into the slave system. Rice was a good crop, but there was more competition from around the world. Tobacco was a good crop, but not one that was going to allow the planters to get rich. Cotton, the ability to grow large amounts of cotton and to process cotton, that certainly helped support the slave system economically, although the South never really got rich the way the North did.
All right, let's take another call. This is Robinson, line one. Hello.
Yes?
Yes, go ahead.
I am sorry this is slightly off the point, but I felt I must respond to the caller from Bloomington, Indiana, who wants to deny evolution and the separation of church and state by pointing out to him and you that at least one of the early state of Illinois constitutions prohibited any preacher from holding a seat in the government. So there was anti-clerical, anti-religious feeling, even when the state of Illinois was settled mostly in the South by people from the slave states. Thank you.
All right.
There is something to be said. The whole issue of church and state has now become one of those issues where people seem to take either one side, as the first caller did, or the second side, which the second caller did. It was a much more unclear issue back in the 1780s and the 1790s. Unitarianism was on the rise. Jefferson in the early 1800s said, "I believe that in 50 years the country is going to be almost completely Unitarian." Washington's religion was certainly not one that could be described as fundamental. John Adams had moved away from the strict dictates of the church, and many of the other people in the 1780s and 1790s had too. What those men believed was that spiritualism, a belief in a higher power. Jefferson was a noted deist, I think I'd say that. The belief in a higher power was important to the moral and spiritual development of people and of the country. It didn't really go past that. They weren't thinking in terms of whether religion should be practiced in the schools, whether there should be prayers before Congress. These were not important issues to these men. They were much more concerned with a basic and fundamental spirituality because they believed that went to a basic and fundamental morality. So the issue was talked about in a very different way back in the 1780s and 1790s than we seem to represent it today.
Yeah. Within the past couple of years, there has been a boom in publishing about American history, particularly the Revolutionary period. And books about the time, and then also books about the people who were the leaders of the time, Washington, Jefferson, Adams, Hamilton, Franklin, just to name
right.
a few. And you wrote an interesting commentary that was published in the Los Angeles Times in September, noting that and also talking about the tendency of some of these books to perhaps avoid some of the darker parts yeah. of American history, and I think that that's interesting. And I'd like to have you talk a little bit about the importance of seeing it for what it is, warts and all, and not simply glossing over those dark chapters.
Oh, you saw that L.A. Times piece, David. Well, what happened? I opened the piece with something that actually happened when I was trying to sell this book, when the proposal was going out. A major New York literary agent, an extremely powerful man, you would all know his books, said, you know, this is a terrific story, but I don't think I can represent this. And I said, well, why not? And he said, you know, in order to be commercial, American history needs to be a story of triumph. He said, like Seabiscuit. He said, the way you're the Constitutional Convention, you're kind of making it a story of failure. And I think that's completely wrong. But it is, you're dealing in a publishing industry where there is an enormous press for success and for bestsellers, and we are living at a time where controversy and discussion of the failings of our founding fathers are not as popular. Even Henry Winsick's book, An Imperfect God, about Washington, talked about him as a slaveholder, but also they happened to pick a man who freed all his slaves on his death. Nobody talks about James Madison, who never freed a slave. So there are, I think, to me, the triumph of America is not that we had these minor deities running around creating our country, but the fact that we had real human beings with failings, with foibles, who could be manipulative, who could be sophisticated, who could be naive, who could work for higher interests or could work for base interests or could work for regional interests, all of whom worked together for their sense that some kind of better system, some kind of higher government could be had, because the one thing they did believe fervently was in democracy, in a system that was not monarchical, that was not autocratic, that would not oppress, that would not deny people the right to practice their religion. So the fact that these men were imperfect, but worked together and struggled, and it took a civil war, and it took a lot of other extremely unpleasant facets of our history, the way the oppression of Native Americans, but in the end, I believe we have come up with a system that is the most fair, the most free, and the most democratic that the world has ever seen. So the idea that we should not look at what we would consider failings or weak points in the founding fathers strikes me as wrongheaded. That the more we make them like us, the more that we see that they are people who struggled with the same issues and the same problems that we struggle with today, might make us a little more willing and a little bit more anxious to struggle with our own failings instead of only looking at things in a rosy light. So I think that's what is happening, and that's why it shouldn't.
That's well, it's, you know, your book really, as we talked about a little earlier, sort of at the heart of the book is to look at the struggle between sectional interests and how they were resolved, and the fact that the interests were, it was not simply this dramatic divide North-South, pro-slavery, anti-slavery. It was, in fact, the interests were commercial interests in the North and in the South, yes, interest in preserving slavery, but in one case, interest in preserving the Atlantic slave trade.
Right.
And the other is, well, yes, we want to keep slavery, but we just assume that the slaves don't come from Africa anymore so that we
right.
in the Upper South can sell them to the Lower South. So, you know, that all these three interests were really in there duking it out in a hard-headed sort of way, and that they did indeed manage to find a way to get something that everybody could sign on. It's interesting, though, that someone would come along and say, well, that ultimately, though, because slavery was preserved at that time, that ultimately this was a failure.
That's right. I mean, it is not a failure when you're forced to wrestle with an issue. Is it laudable? Is it pleasant to think about that the northern commercial interests were willing to simply ignore slavery? And the other thing about slavery was they didn't take a moral position one way or another. There were moral statements in the convention, and they're oft quoted. But these were statements simply to influence votes. I got the distinct impression that if the geographic situation had been reversed, and that the slaves had been in New England, and that the South Carolinians were shipping, that the New England delegates would have said exactly the same things as the South Carolinians did, and the South Carolinians would have said the same things the New England delegates did. It simply was another aspect of the life with which they were faced, and the regional interests with which they were faced, and the problems they needed to resolve before they were going to have a central government. The moral issue of slavery was not seriously debated in Philadelphia, and that may be one of the reasons they didn't want the debates made public. It was very clear. You know, as I said, the second a detailed record of the debates was published, the abolitionists in the North just went ballistic, and they saw what an emphasis it was. It wasn't simply what the Constitution said, because they already knew that, but what they saw was how the Constitution was created and the various interests that were abolitionist in public who were certainly less so in private.
Well, there we will leave it, and again, mention that if you want to read more in this story, you look for the book Dark Bargain, Slavery, Profits, and the Struggle for the Constitution. It's published by Walker & Company by our guest, Lawrence Goldstone. And Mr. Goldstone, thank you very much.
Thank you very much for having me, David.